Okay, so we need to talk about computer-supported cooperative work. So I'm thanking Nicolas Roussel here, who's one of my former students, who's now at INREA in Lille. He taught this course a few years back, and I had done slides, and he stole my slides, and I stole his slides. So I'm giving him credit for some of the things you'll see in these presentations. So we're going to have 8 classes. I am not going to teach all of them. In particular, not next week, but the week after, we'll have a class by Jean-Claude Martin, who was going to teach the class on virtual humans. Maybe you remember the presentation. We had to cancel the class because it was not enough interest overall. But I've asked him to come and talk about virtual humans in the context of collaborative environments. There will be another class taught by Mehdi Ami, also from LIMSI, who will talk about collaborative virtual environments, things where you have immersive systems for collaboration. And maybe there will be a third course taught by someone else. I am not sure yet, so I will let you know. In terms of your work, apart from listening to me and participating, what I would like to do is to give you some papers to read. And since it's a small group, it would be good that we have short presentations of papers, so we are going to start probably next week, if that's okay with you. If someone wants to pick an article, you can work in a pair as well and give a short presentation of what you learned in the article the following week or 2 weeks later. So, article presentations. The other thing is, I would like to have a small project where you design something and maybe program it. So I don't know how many of you are comfortable with programming. Yes? 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 Yes, so? Okay. And again, I think it would be good if you can work in pairs. I don't know if we are even number yet, but apparently it is so far. The thing is, I'm not necessarily interested in something where there is programming. It's okay to design a system and do mock-ups, video prototypes. You're going to learn. Are all of you taking design of interactive systems as well? Wendy's course?
No.
No? Oh, okay, so you don't want to work more than... okay.
No. We can be here...
You can program in small talk. What about that?
Yeah. But we can take this course only until Christmas.
Okay. Well, so we'll see how this goes. But what I'm saying is that it doesn't have to be a programming project. It can be a design project where you imagine a collaborative system without necessarily having to implement it. I think maybe today, more likely next week, I can give you a small demo of a system that is now fairly widespread to program interactive and collaborative web applications. And so all the programming is done in JavaScript, so if you're a bit familiar with web programming, that would be easy. But there are other ways to program collaborative systems. So there will be a small design project, and then of course, we need to have a grade with a written exam, so there'll be some kind of written exam at the end. And so we'll figure this out as we go. I have to tell you that for the month of December, I am a little bit busy, because as you know, we're running this big conference next year. In 10 days from now, we have the program committee for this conference. It means there are 200 people coming from all over the world to decide what will be presented at the conference, and so we are organizing this meeting. And when they are done, then we have to put all the content they've picked into a program for the conference. And that has to be done essentially mostly before Christmas. So I'm going to be very busy until then. And on top of that, I have to travel, which is why the course, not next week, but the week after, will be taught by Jean-Claude. So I have not created yet a website, but I know where it will be. I have to start at the beginning.
Oops.
So it's the same one as for the intro class. So www.lri.fr/tildemdl, that's me, /ENS for enseignement in French, teaching, /CSCW, like CSCW. Okay, any questions on these general comments? So computer-supported cooperative work, or as I just said, CSCW. So today I'm going to give an introduction we'll spend most of the time talking about an overview of things that fall under this large area called CSCW. And then in the coming classes, we'll look at each of these aspects in much more detail. So the first thing is, why are we interested in computer-supported cooperative work? And why is that different from human-computer interaction in general? Well, the first observation is that humans are social beings. Most animals, in fact, are social beings. Humans are social beings, and literally groups structure how we organize human activity. From our private life, where it goes with families and friends and sport teams and associations and choirs and all sorts of ways to organize your sort of private life around different groups of people who have joint activities, who share interests, who share artifacts, who share things. And same in the professional life, where people very often work in teams or part at least of some kind of a structure. And the very frequent structure in professional life is hierarchical structure. And in hierarchical structures, you have two main ways of looking at it in terms of social activities. One is the horizontal slices, so, the team working under a manager, but the other way is the management chain. You know that you report to someone, reports to someone, reports to someone, and that's another aspect of group activity. And in fact, there are very few things that you do all by yourself, only for yourself, and that do not involve anybody else. The value, of course, is that, and that's true for humans as well as for animals, is that groups, once you put people together, you get more than the sum of their parts. You get more than the individuals put together. What you can start doing is division of labor, distribute work among a set of people so that collectively they can do something that nobody could do individually. Now, you can also make it so it could be done by one person, but it would take too much time. So by distributing it over several people, it takes less time. But I think it's more interesting to look at it as being able to do things together that you're not able to do alone. And that's because people have different expertise, and you can take advantage of this for structuring the division of labor. And people also can transfer skills to each other through teaching and learning. So, all of this, of course, is pretty obvious, there are sciences that studies is group activities, mainly what would be a science and studies groups?
Sociology?
Hmm?
Sociology.
Sociology, yes. Other sciences that are interested in
anthropology.
Hmm?
Anthropology.
Anthropology, yes.
Communication.
Communication.
I don't know if that's a communication science.
Management.
Maybe.
Yeah, management. Okay. I would add ethnography.
Biology. Sometimes.
Well, there is social biology. And that means that all these sciences are in fact going to be interesting for working on this topic of how computers can help groups. Because the goal of CSCW is how computers can help groups get better. What happened? Where are my pictures? Thank you, PowerPoint. I don't know. It's here. It's here.
Maybe that's an animation.
No, no, I don't do animation. It's too sophisticated for me. Well, I haven't seen that before, so.
Maybe it will appear after I go on.
Spooky. So humans are social, but computers are mostly personal. And that may seem a weird statement to you, who spend your time on, I'm sure, Twitter and Facebook, but we'll get to that in a moment. But really, computers were created as things to be used by usually one person at a time. And of course, here I'm taking a picture that is interesting, maybe historically. But the interesting thing to think about is that when we moved from big computers to mainframes and we invented time sharing, that is, when computers became powerful enough that a single person couldn't make use of it in an efficient way, the idea was to make it so that different users could access the computer as if it were their own personal computer. And if you look at the operating systems, including those we use today, every day, Unix is under the hood for Linux and macOS. On Windows, things are fairly similar at this level. What you have is a system where processes are independent from each other, and everything is done so that they can live independently of each other. If multiple users can log in, they are kept in isolation of each other. And there are very few tools on these operating systems to figure out what the others are doing. Now, you are mostly using personal computers, such as laptops or smartphones or whatever, and then you're using shared services like, that are in the cloud. And certainly, the personal computer is personal, and the services in the cloud, what they sell you is a slice of cloud that is your own, supposedly. And so if you take an example of how the file system, for example, is managed on an operating system on your computer, if one process on your system is opening a file, reading a file, writing to a file, it's very difficult for another process on this computer to know that this particular file is being opened, written, or read by another process. So at the level of the basic resources that are managed by an operating system, processes, file system, network, connections, things like this, everything is done so you are kept in the dark about what others are doing. So when I say computers are personal, I'm not just talking about the personal computer that is used indeed by one person at a time. I'm also talking about the way you get access to shared computers that does, in a way that does not support collaborative aspects, such as knowing what the others are doing. Oh, I see. Yeah. So we have this sort of big divide between the fact that humans naturally do things together, but computers are really personal tools. And this is citing Don Norman, who of course is not the only or the first one to have observed this, that most work done on any complex entity is done by more than one person. Here's an example of a cockpit of an airplane. And of course, we know that we need to work together, and we know that we are using computers to work together. And the question is, are the computer systems we use really facilitating group work? Now, you've been, doing projects, programming projects, or writing reports, or doing things in computers in groups. And so what's your take on this? Do you think that everything is fine and there's nothing to be invented? Or what are the problems you run into when you try to do collaborative tasks with computers?
Yeah, I used Git once.
Yes?
No, I don't want to remember that.
Yes, I'm like you. I've been using what's called version control systems for 25 years, and I just don't get Git. The funny thing is, everybody I say, oh, it's great, you should use it.
That was my problem.
And then you talk to them in private, and they say they hate it. So there's some, fashion about it that you're supposed to like.
Yeah, that's what I got.
Okay, so version control systems in general. This is an interesting set of collaborative systems because they are supposedly designed to help people work together. Do they really work?
The big disadvantage for version control systems, they are only talk in terms of text, not in semantic way. You cannot save a refactor or save a big change with name. You are changing text and comparing.
Yes. So they are very low level, in a sense.
I think it was last year in this Motor conference, then we participated in a workshop that was called Wolfpack programming. And they had a really collaborative environment, so many people could go together in the same place. And it's also a mess. It was really messy. They wanted to experiment on what would be like if a group of some sort of wolves were following an alpha wolf.
I'm trying to work.
Something like that. And attack the same issue all together. And it's also a mess. It was different from version control systems because everybody was actually working on the same thing at the same time. Version control system is like you take turns and you don't really know what the other is doing. Maybe then you have to merge.
Yes.
But it still needed work.
So other, yes?
I think that the most of the software that is successful in collaborative work, it focuses on how to protect the set of data, right? And reading. They don't focus on how...
Exactly. And so the take on collaboration is that it makes things hard on the computer because you don't want people to mess with each other's data.
How do you protect my document, yes. Not how can I cover it?
And so what do people do in the end? All the time,
work
instead
alone.
Of really sharing things?
Work
alone.
They work alone, and they work in sequence. They say, well, I'll work on this, and I'll send you the file, and then you work, and when you're done, you send it to me, and this is how we use technology today.
And even the version of the system forces you to work in sequence. You can spend a lot on the same function, on the same file, otherwise you need a manual manager afterwards.
Exactly. So, for example, we, as a researcher, a lot of my activity is writing research papers, and this is mostly most of the time a group exercise, and every time it's a problem if we use Word, we are forced to sequential things, or merging by hand, which is a pain. If we use things like LaTeX, we end up chopping the document into files for each of the section. But there are still things that cause problems with that, so we spend a lot of time sending email or chatting to each other saying, oh, I'm taking control over this file while you're working on this bit, etc. And so, to me, it strikes me that research on this is not new. I think all of you, or most of you at least, have taken the class, the intro class, and I showed bits of video of Engelbart's work in 1968, where already in this system, NLS Augment, you had sharing file, sharing really documents, hypertext documents in that, supporting personal annotations of these documents, electronic messaging, real-time email, if you wish, video conferencing, which we see here. This is not a photo montage in Photoshop. There really is a diagram here on the screen superimposed with the image of the person, and there's audio so they can talk live. Screen sharing, telepointers, having each one have their own pointers on the screen and being able to interact with that, etc., etc. So this was done in 1968. There's not half of these features that you can use today in systems.
That we want in that, because everything that we got,
I know, and so, but I think there's an interesting, and in fact, a lot of the writing that's been done in the CSCW community has been trying to understand why this always fails miserably. Because people have tried again and again to create systems that support collaboration, and they don't work. Now, there are many reasons for that, and one of the papers I will give you as reading is by Jonathan Brudin, and talks about problems that people have run into when they've tried to deploy those systems. So there are some problems that are, oftentimes you assume that everybody is going to use the same system. And in some organizations, you can force that into people. So for example, IBM created the, Lotus created a system called Lotus Notes. Then it was acquired by IBM. And I know, you know, several organizations that have been destroyed literally by Lotus Notes. I know one in France, because Lotus Notes is a system that takes over all of your documents, all of your email, all of your everything. And so you are, you know, you have to be in Lotus Notes all the time. I know an organization that switched to Lotus Notes. Another small one, it was EDF, the French electricity company. They almost, not all of EDF, but their R&D part, they almost died because for weeks and weeks they didn't have email and people could just not adapt to the way they were supposed to work. And so one issue with CSCW system is that the way they are designed, oftentimes they force everybody to work on the same system. And when you collaborate, a key thing is that we're all different. So I was taking the example of writing an article. Why is it that if I decide to use Word, everybody has to use Word? Why, in some tools, you know, you all have to use exactly the same tool. If I want to do a video chat, we have to all be either under Skype or under Google Groups or under iChat. And I think this is a terrible mistake to imagine that you will force people. It's as if everybody to speak on the phone, if you had to have the exact same, you know, model of phone, otherwise it wouldn't work. Now you understand why, from a business perspective, the tendency is to say, well, I want to impose my product, so you have to use my product, or you can't use it. But again, if you look at the history, this has proven wrong again and again. Every time technology for in particular communication, and communication, as we'll see, is a big part of CSCW. Every communication technology that has taken off, the reason it has taken off is because they agreed on the standard for transporting things, whether it's a phone line, whether it's an IM messaging protocol, you know, video conferencing or things like this, so that then you can have different companies build their terminals. And then once you start creating a communication system, of course, it becomes more interesting the more people are connected to it. So you have this network effect of communication systems. But even with that, I would like to show you a short video here. And I don't know if you recognize the movie already. No?
Not yet.
Not yet. Is this going to play?
I'm sorry. Right.
So I don't have the audio cable, but you don't need much sound.
Sweetheart, but I can't.
Why not?
You know, Daddy's traveling. Very sorry about it, but I just can't.
I am.
I can send you a very nice present, though.
All right.
Anything special that you want?
Yes.
What?
A telephone.
We got lots of telephones already. Have to think of anything else you want for your birthday? Something very special?
Yes.
What?
A bush baby.
Well, we'll have to see about that. Listen, sweetheart, I want you to tell Mommy something for me. Will you remember?
Yes.
Tell Mommy that I telephone, okay?
Yes.
And then I'll try to telephone again tomorrow. Now, will you tell her that?
Yes.
Okay, sweetheart. Now, have a nice birthday tomorrow.
Okay.
Have a nice birthday party tomorrow, too, huh? Okay, now take care and be a good girl, won't you?
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Happy birthday.
Okay, so, which movie?
No.
2001, Space Odyssey. He was orbiting around the moon. That's why he was calling. And that was the video phone.
It's too long.
Yeah, there's some boring parts. But there's a. I love the intro part of 2001 when the monkeys discover the use of the tool, and I've talked about that already. Anyway.
What's your inspiration?
Yes, exactly. So the reason I showed this this clip here is because I was talking about communication technologies. And there has been many, many attempts at creating tools to support shared activities, like authoring of documents and things like this. And they basically all failed, to the extent that today we don't share. You have these sharing buttons everywhere on the web, but you're not sharing. When you share an image on Facebook or anything, what are you really doing? Are you really sharing the image?
You post?
No, you post it, exactly. You send it. You send a copy of it. And that's very different, because it's a difference between sharing, we are looking at the same artifact, so if I change it, everybody sees the changes. But, so that's one thing. Exchanging documents, sending copies of documents is something else altogether. And it has big consequences because the fact that sharing on the web is not sharing, or in the web, or on the internet in general is not sharing, means that once I've, quote, shared it, it's not mine anymore. And I have no control whatsoever over it. However, one thing that has worked extremely well is every communication technology. And that has been, you know, probably one of the defining factor of humanity, is to create ways of communicating, of course through language, and through coded language. There is an excellent book that has come out a year or two ago by James Gleick. It's called The Information. And I recommend reading it. It's a pretty big book. But it's fascinating because it starts with tribes in Africa communicating by banging, you know, on the trees and having a code to communicate at a distance. So it starts, you know, way before any kind of electronic system, and it shows this evolution and how people have again and again reinvented ways of communicating with each other. And its communication is so powerful that a lot of technologies that we take for granted today were not developed for this type of use originally. So the telephone. So originally, the telephone was not designed for one-to-one communication. It was designed for group broadcast of information. The idea would be that a person, the manager of a floor, say in a store, would take the phone to address all of his employees at once. And it's only through accidents that people realize that, yeah, they like to talk to one another rather than, you know, having this broadcast mechanism, and then the telephone was turned into a one-to-one medium. Interestingly, years later, the same happened with SMS, or text messaging. The telephone companies did not anticipate the success of SMS at all. They put this in as sort of a hack.
It was free, actually. In the beginning, it was free, SMS.
Yes.
Because they thought it would be interesting.
Right. And they realized people were using it like crazy. And then now they overcharge like crazy. Another example is in France, for those of you who have been in France, there used to be a system called the Minitel, which predates the web. And it was a terminal you had at home, and that gave you access to a number of online services. And when the French Telecom put this together, their model for these online services were the white pages, the yellow pages, the schedules of the trains, the planes, you know, maybe online shopping and things like this. So it was again a one-to-many or many-to-one types of communication. You know, I go online to get information. And then in the original system, they had this thing where the engineers from the telecom companies, they did a small-scale experiment with a few hundred families, and they observed how they were using it. And the engineers had a way to send a message on the bottom line of the terminal that looked to the user as if it came from the system. And the idea was to give them help when they could see they were kind of stuck. And then one of these users were hackers who were able to actually turn this to their advantage so they could send messages to each other. Which of course the telecom engineers hated because that was not the goal. And people started to essentially chat or SMS with each other through the system. And the big success of the Minitel in France was messaging system, chat rooms and the like. There are other examples. We'll see other examples when we talk about video mediated communication of systems where you put a video screen, a camera between two public places in two cities so people can see each other and instantly they communicate. So, you know, we are wired for communication, and we will use and appropriate any technology for especially one-to-one communication. And I think the key with social networks these days is that they are communication systems, even though, again, they were not really designed to be communication systems in the first place. They were, I mean, if you look at the history of Facebook, it was, you know, cataloged. And or your book. So as long as you talk about communication, I think people are starting to understand this notion that you need to agree on the medium, on the protocol, and then people can build different terminals, and then you naturally generate the power of the exponential law of interconnecting everything with everybody else. But when it comes to other aspects of group work, and particularly sharing things, I don't think we've found the right recipe yet. So between NLS augment in the 60s and the emergence of the field of computer-supported cooperative work, it took, you know, another 15 years. So the term CSCW was apparently coined for the first time by Aaron Grief in 1984. The term groupware, which is software that supports group work, came out in about 82. For those interested in the French words, in French we supposed to say collecticiel, which I think is a nice translation for groupware. Logiciel is software, and collecticiel is collective software. This is a straight translation of CSCW. And so, shortly after this term started to emerge, and a number of people were interested in that topic, conferences started to emerge as well. So the CSCW conference from ACM and the European CSCW have been around since around 1986. A few years later, the journal CSCW came up. And so it's, you know, a field that is about 15 years younger in a sense than HCI, although the first HCI conferences are not that much older. And interestingly, maybe because it touches on many more aspects than straight human-computer interaction, maybe because it touches upon, as we said before, management and communication and other things, it's not as strong a field as I think it should be. Because I think really all we do with computers has to do with group work. Maybe another reason why the field is not as developed is because there is still this very bipolar aspect of the field where you have, on the one hand, people who come from social sciences, and we were talking about anthropology, I mentioned ethnography, and these are sciences where what you do is you observe. You observe, you report what you observe, you create frameworks to try to carefully generalize some of the things, but you don't intervene. You don't come in and you say, oh, let me try this, let me use this technology and see what happens. And so a lot of papers and even books you will find around CSCW will take the social approach, where we observe how people use technology, appropriate technology, what they do with it, but we don't put our hands in the game. So Liam Bannon here and Hale Schmidt wrote a paper, which I'll put online, that talks about, you know, what's in the work, what's in computer-supported cooperative work, and they do this kind of analysis of what this means and what how people understand it. And this is a quote from this article: CSCW should be conceived as an endeavor to understand the nature and characteristics of cooperative work. So the focus is on understand. And the goal and for them it's a long-term goal, and it's maybe not even their problem, is to design adequate computer-based technology. Now, clashing with this sub-community coming from social sciences in general, you have the people who are coming from the computer science and say, well, we need to build a better system, and we'll see what people do with it. And so Clarence Seebus, who was one of the really early creators of the field, came actually from databases, wrote another paper, which I'll put online, where they define groupware as computer-based systems. So, you know, the emphasis is, well, this is a software that support groups of people. So there's a notion of group here, engaged in a common task or a common goal. So it's not just groups of people each doing their own thing. They have a common task or goal. And there is this notion of a shared environment, so you have access to shared resources on the computer. So this is a very sort of more engineering definition based on, you know, okay, here's the thing we are building. And then if you go a little bit deeper, you can dig out definitions like this one. Groupware is distinguished from normal software by the basic assumption it makes. So that's to distinguish groupware from regular software. It makes the user aware that he is part of a group, while most other software seeks to hide and protect users from each other. So this is what I was saying earlier. In traditional operating systems and systems in general, even if you support multiple users, you don't want them to know what each other is doing. The goal of groupware is to support what we call awareness, group awareness. I'm in this class. I'm aware that you're in front of me, that you're taking notes, that you're paying attention, or maybe not. If, you know, I was in my office and you were, each of you, at your desk behind a computer, and we were connected with some kind of group communication system, I would lose a lot of the awareness cues that I have in the room here. If we didn't have a video link, I couldn't see you, that would be pretty dramatic difference. Even with video, you only have a very small field of view, poor resolution, so you don't see all the details that are very important to coordinate our activities. So, I don't know why some of this are like this, I guess. So, creating groupware systems is really difficult. It's not immediately obvious what it should do. And part of the problem is we oftentimes get this wrong. In one of the papers from Jonathan Gruden that I was mentioning, he studied the reuse of group calendars. In the early days, the notion of a group calendar was a big thing in CSW, because people identified that in professional organizations, people spend a lot of time figuring out when they're going to have a meeting. And so they said, yeah, well, easy. We're going to have a shared calendar so that everybody can see what everybody else's schedule is. And you can make it so that it protects privacy. So, you know, I can see that you are busy the day. I don't need to know what you're doing that day at the time, but I can figure out, you know, if you're busy or not. And so the idea was group calendars were going to help people schedule meetings. And every single place where they put this in, it didn't work. And the reason is, and I think it's very nicely analyzed by Gruden, is that there is this imbalance between those who have to do more work because of the system being in place, and those who benefit from the system being in place. And in organizations, things are hierarchical. So essentially, the manager and the people working for him are not you know, don't have the same rights. And so what happened is every employee had to have their calendar up to date, but the manager didn't have to. On the other hand, the manager could look at everybody's calendar and say, okay, I'm scheduling a meeting now, at this time, this day, and it's up to you to clear your time to make it work. And so people were having to reveal more information about themselves, spend more time putting stuff into the system, and instead of getting the benefits out of it, they were getting, you know, more constraints in the sense of being told what to do at time. So a lot of the issue with groupware is really what it should do. And we were talking earlier about version control systems. And that's a good example too, where you start from a very naive analysis of what the problem is, you build complex systems, because that's another aspect, is these systems are hard to build. So once you've got something that works, you don't want to start from scratch. So you build this complex system based on naive assumptions and not understanding the dynamics of groups and the aspects that make this kind of systems fail. So how to design them? Even more than for a traditional interactive system, you have to involve users. Because every time you go in and you put in a groupware system, you will realize that there are some group dynamics in the organization that you didn't understand in the first place. And it can vary for the same type of activity from one company to the next, from one culture to the next, etc. And cultural aspects are quite critical because oftentimes you don't notice them. So, and that's the last part of it is we already talked a little bit about in the intro class about how interactive systems affect the way people behave and use systems. So they adapt to the system, but they also adapt systems to their needs. This is even more true with groupware systems. And so you need to not just not only anticipate, because in general it's not possible, but also observe how people use your system and make changes to adapt to the fact that people change their behaviors. Obvious example is the way, you know, people use cell phones in public places. You all look at me like, what? Well, when cell phones started coming out, it was not socially acceptable to talk in the middle of the street with your phone. You had phone booths, and they all were closed in. So, you know, and I remember when these were all over the place, that if people were on the phone in there with the door open, it was considered rude. There was a study, in fact, made in the early days of cell phones, where a group of researchers went into the stores and interviewed people who were about to buy their first cell phone. And they asked them a number of questions about what they would consider rude or normal use of the phone in various situations. And everybody, well, probably not everybody, but, you know, most people said it would be rude to use it in public space in particular, things like this. Then they followed up, and after 3 months, they came back to the same people and they asked them, so how are you using the phone? And they had completely changed, and for them it was normal, and it would be rude, in fact, to not answer the phone in public space because you're supposed to be reachable all the time. And so that's the thing where, you know, was that predictable or not? I don't know, but in any case, you have to make sure you can observe that change of behavior so that you can adapt your system to it. And now you have all these things on your phone, so you can put in a buzzer, you can have things where it changes its mode automatically, you can have different rings depending on who calls, so you know if you should or should not answer. You even have apps. I discovered that on the App Store, you have an app where you can program it so it calls you at some time. So when you're in a boring meeting, you can find an excuse to go out of the meeting, etc. So, so this is really a very important aspect of the success of the system, is to really understand that we don't understand really group dynamics. So as we said, it's a multidisciplinary field, and the problems are, of course, technical, and these systems are very hard to build. Every groupware system is a distributed system, so anybody who's done a little bit of computer science knows that writing a program that runs on multiple computers and multiple processes is hard in the first place. But the problems are also human, and when I say that the problems are human, the problem is understanding how humans work in groups and the subtle group dynamics and how this can be taken into account when you design the system. And therefore, the solutions are also both technical and human. And for example, I'll talk at the end a little bit about privacy. But the issue of privacy cannot be solved purely technically. There's no way you can make a system that is that protects your privacy just by building whatever infrastructure you want. At some point, there needs to be a human aspect where you say, well, there are rules. And for example, in France, email communication is protected. Even if you're in the workplace, it's considered personal. And even though, I mean, I won't go into what actually happens, but even though an employer has the technical capability of looking at your email, if he does it, he's breaking the law. And there is no way you can make a system where, I wouldn't say probably there is no way, but making a system where nobody can ever see your email in the clear is probably not practical. So you need to have what we call socio-technical systems that combine technical aspects with social aspects, including social rules, the what used to be called, I don't know if people use this term again still, the netiquette, you know, the sort of conventions on how to behave when you're online, and all the way to legal aspects where things are considered legal or illegal, even though maybe the technology allows you to do it. So, to finish this opening part, before we start looking at examples, I would like to show you this first taxonomy of CCW systems and groupware. So this is a functional taxonomy in that it distinguishes among three types of things you do in groupware systems. So the first and most obvious one is communication. Well, what is communication is the exchange of information between participants. And whether this is by sending text through email or through instant messaging or whatever, or photos or other types of documents, the communication is really the notion that it's the technology is the channel, the medium between humans. So, first aspect, communication. The second one is this notion of sharing, and again, sharing understood in the true meaning of the world where multiple people have access to the same computer artifacts. Have you ever used a shared document editor?
Yeah, Google Docs.
Oh, yeah, okay, Google Docs. So, good example, right? So in Google Docs, we are all editing the same document. Now, sometimes, we'll see a lot of things about shared editors, so let me save this for later. And then there's a third aspect, and that's what we call coordination. And this is really about how do you organize the distribution of labor participants. Now, a lot of the time, and in the examples we were taking with version control systems, the coordination was done through a communication mean, where we exchange email or we talk to each other if we're in the same room, saying, oh, I'm taking control over this, don't touch it. But this is what coordination is about, is how we organize the work around the shared artifacts so we can coordinate our activities. So we'll see systems, for an example, is workflow systems, where the coordination is, in fact, managed by the system itself. And it's not done through communication. Now, I've shown this with the three circles, and the three circles overlap. And so, when we look at systems, and I will warn you now that at the end, we're gonna, well, you are going to do an exercise, which is to tell me, for a number of the systems that we'll talk about, you know, what part of this they cover. And you'll find systems that are really purely communications, some that combine communication and sharing, some that combine communication and coordination, etc. So we have all, what is it, six, seven possibilities.
So, can you explain again, in coordination, the system makes a decision?
No. It can be the end users, it can be the system, it can be some combination. But someone has to organize the work.
But it's not so, it's not that we communicate and we decide who we
work. Well, you can, when you communicate to coordinate, and that would then fall under coordination, even though it's achieved through communication. You can coordinate by sharing. If I go into the file I'm editing and I put a comment at the top that says, you know, I'm working on this, I put it in a shared artifact, and then the next person comes in, checks it out, said, oh, he's working on it, so I shouldn't touch it. So it didn't involve communication. It was a coordination task carried out through a shared artifact. But then there are systems whose only purpose is to do the coordination, and they tend to be called workflow systems, I'll talk about it, but if you have, in many companies, you have documents that need to go through one service to another service. So someone does an invoice, orders something, so you need to ship the products, and then it goes to invoicing and then getting the money, and etc. And so in that case, people don't coordinate by talking to each other explicitly. It's more that the system says, well, you know, it's there, and when you say it's done, I know the next step is to give it to this other person. So the coordination is supported by the system in that case. So you will find that many of these things can be not only overlapped, but each activity can be carried out by one of the other means, which makes the analysis a little bit more difficult, but you also find that, I mean, I haven't found examples so far where you couldn't break it down into these three aspects. So what I would like to do now is to start a sample of a number of groupware systems. And there are lots and lots of them, so I'm not trying to be exhaustive. I don't think one can be exhaustive. In this presentation, I will try to maybe focus a bit more on older stuff that you're less likely to know, or if you know them, you maybe are not aware that they have been around for a lot of time. And we'll revisit a lot of these when we talk about various types of CSCW systems in the next classes. So the oldest really groupware is probably email. Although it's an interesting story, email. And I maybe have told it to you already, but you don't remember. So the story of email. So do you know how email came out to be?
You said something.
Yeah, yeah. No, I didn't remember something. Well, email started as file sharing. So what happened in the early days is that there were few computers, and the computers that existed were very specialized. So there were computing centers, typically in the United States, and the operators of these computers were given jobs to run on the computer. And the job was typically a program plus a data set and run program in the data set. Now, if their computer was not designed for this kind of thing, they had to send the file to another computing center that would do the job and then send the file back. So it was really, originally the idea was that you needed to transmit files to run jobs on the remote computer. And the way to transmit the files, there was a way to give a message to the operator at the other end saying, well, could you please run this for me, or whatever instructions needed to be sent. And so the message was attached to a file that was being shared. And then they started realizing that, well, they could create empty jobs, essentially, just to attach a message to say hi to to you know, the people they knew, and to communicate through these messages. And then somebody realized, well, that's cool. We should do a real messaging system whose only purpose is to do messaging. And so I think there's this interesting, you know, reversal thing in history where nowadays you attach files to messages, but originally you were attaching messages to files. Now the thing is, email quickly became incredibly popular. Although it was popular over a very small population, because you know, in the early days, even if here we're talking 87, 83, 84, few people had access to email. I had access to email when I arrived here, and that was in 83. And the system we had was once a day sending all the messages that had been typed in that day, collecting everything that had been received, and so we had sort of one distribution of mail per day. And it took years before we had a permanent connection to the internet. But yes, I had, and a number of my colleagues had email then. And Wendy, at the time, a little bit around this time, 87, started working at MIT with Tom Malone, and in her thesis, she looked at the notion of email overload. Now at the time, and actually could tell you better than I can, people had no idea that this was a potential problem, because you know, you had a few messages per day. But in places like Xerox PARC, where people have started having workstations with Ethernet connection, they were communicating with email more and more. And so she could see that, you know, there was a trend there, something that was bound to explode. And so she did very interesting studies of the use of email at Xerox PARC. And with Tom Malone, they worked on a system called the information lens. And the idea of the information lens was to say, well, email is very nice, but it's the humans doing all the work. We have to tell who the message is for, the subject line, the content. It's a pretty dumb thing in the end. The system is only transporting messages and only looking really at the two lines to see who to send it to,
route it to the proper destination, and that's it. Now, of course, there were things like distribution lists where one address could then branch out to multiple destinations, but email was pretty dumb. And so what it said is, okay, well, in an email message, you have, it's a semi-structured document. You have a part that is heavily structured. It's the headings, or the headers, because we know this is from, this is copied to, this is the subject. So this is something the computer can analyze and make something with. Then there is the text of the message, and we're not going there. I mean, yes, we could do, you know, text analysis, but the text is the text. And so what if we did a system where we could use these headers so that the emails could be processed by the email system more intelligently? So one thing is they invented the notion of rules. How many of you use rules in their email system?
Thousands of them.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
Everything is perfectly organized in its folder because of the rules.
When you say group, you're saying features.
I'm control freak about rules.
Yes.
Yeah?
I usually start using filters when things get messy.
Okay.
Not as maybe she does, like, I'm going to receive messages from another course, so I'm going to make a filter for this. No. Once that get messy, then I...
Okay, well, that's good. I have given up. Well, because the problem I have with filters is that when I filter email and organize them, for me, out of sight, out of mind. So if I have email that gets stored automatically in some folder, I will never have the time to get there and see what's there. So if I don't see them go in front of my eyes, they're...
I do not receive many mail without the everywhere I receive now. It has a
okay.
I never receive many mails anymore.
You have to tell that to Wendy because she will love it. In her study, so she was working with people at Park, and they were using an information lens, and they were creating rules to sort their email. They could also make rules that created automated responses, or at least pre-compose a reply, and you just have to fill in the blanks and things like this. One of the things she realized during her interviews is that she said, well, one of her questions was, well, what happens if the rule doesn't work? And the people looked at her like, what? What do you mean? Could the rule not work? And they were panicked because they had never realized that, yeah, you write a rule, but if you don't write it properly, it's not going to do the right thing, and you may lose or miss messages and things like this. Now, once you have rules, and if you get people to use rules a lot, well, the information support is the notion of sending an email to anyone. And anyone meant, and that was meant to be used inside an organization, not at the scale we have today, of course, but anyone who would have a rule that would grab this message as opposed to discard it. So in this case, what you're doing is you completely shifting the burden of deciding who should get the message from the sender to the receiver, who now has to sort of shield himself with the filters to. And this is an example where it's something that is a very good idea and it's very useful, but immediately people overuse it. Because it's so easy to say, well, I'll send this to anyone, we'll see what happens. Just sending yourself the milliseconds it would take to think about who should really receive this, not realizing that by the same time you are, you know, opening the gates to everybody sending you stuff as well. Right. And so this is an example of something that was a failure, even though it was a good idea. There's two things I want to say about email. Well, first of all, it's amazing to me that it's been around for so long time, and it hasn't changed. And even though we are flooded with email, the email browsers we have are all really crappy, frankly. Because what do they give you? A list of messages that, yes, you can sort, and that's it. And you know, I know there are some features that you can add to this. I'm trying to use a thing to add tags to my email, and I still can't decide if it's worth the time or not. But I keep trying to see if I will get some benefit out of it. The role of email has completely changed. People, certainly I use email as my to-do list. And lots of people do that. And lots of people have studied email and how people use email. And the reason a lot of people don't use filters is because filters get the email before it gets to you. And so the thing I would like to have is filters that tell me in one button, this is what I think you should do with that email, but I need to see it. If it's not in my input stream of email, it's gone. And I'll tell you, if I don't reply to some of your email, it's because it scrolled off the top of my list and, you know, it's gone.
I actually use filters for tagging, but as you, I don't like to archive them.
Okay,
so you do
it post hoc.
As well.
Yeah.
Most of my filtering is about tagging. And
yes.
Of course, I have different tags with different colors, so I have immediate feedback where it's what. But I do not risk to lose any email.
Right. I think that filtering is good for things you need to do very often. And that can be automated easily, so you gain a lot of time.
But also filtering depends on people following some social rules, like putting the proper subject lines so your filter works. I mean, I'm running this conference. It's called CHI 2013. I can't get there's 100 people in the committee. But, you know, sometimes they will say CHI 13, CHI 2013, with a space, without a space, with a quote, and sometimes they don't put it at all. And so it's very frustrating. And so there should be better tools to help people normalize their subject line and putting more metadata, in fact, in the emails, so you can process them more efficiently.
And for uncertainty, the filter doesn't work because it's impossible. When you have a match, you can do it. But I use it with the option skip inbox or not skip inbox. So that reminds me in Attack that I need to read it.
Yeah.
So that's how I...
Yeah. But so the first thing is, I still think that we could do so much better email systems. And it's surprising that it's not happening. And I don't know, the other day I was looking at something that was advertised. It's this really brand new, sort of revolutionary email system. And you look at it, it's the same old list of messages. The second thing is, the success of email is because what email is just a protocol. It's SMTP, which S stands for simple. Simple mail transfer protocol. And because you have the SMTP protocol defining email, it means that anybody can install an SMTP server, SMTP client, email client, and everybody can have email. And if you compare this with other things we're going to talk about later, but my best example is social networks. I mean, social networks, they similar to email, they all do more or less the same thing, right? But you have to decide up front, am I going to be on Facebook or on MySpace? Well, I don't think you really have to think a lot of time about these two. But why is it that everybody who wants to be on Facebook has to be on Facebook? Why is Facebook a company, and why is it holding all of my data, and why is it that with email I can hold my email? There's nothing that prevents a social network system to work like email. Yes? No?
Except business and marketing.
Except, yes. Except the fact that they want to make money by selling your personal data to other people.
But I think when you have emails and you want to store it, for example, in Gmail, you start to losing space. And when you post
something... But I don't want Gmail. Gmail is what email would be if it were invented today. And that's the thing that drives me crazy, is I want to own my email. I want to decide where it lives. If I'm happy with Google hosting it, fine. But if I want to have it on my machine, I personally would rather. And so the thing is, by shifting things from what a system is defined in terms of a protocol to defining it in terms of a service, you completely prevent this explosion of this competition among people providing different pieces of the system.
One problem that I find regarding owning an email or, you know, a post in my wall or things like that, is that if I own it, it becomes sort of static. Other people can change it because it's mine. I have it in my computer instead of the cloud. How can you own a thing and still
share.
Be collaborative?
Well, I mean, I think this is a nice way to put it, and it's. We ran a project in around 2000, which was about helping families to communicate, to stay in touch. And they were all using, you know, phones and SMS and email and things like this. So we were not going to redefine these things, but there were things that this system did not cover in terms of their needs to stay in touch. And so we created a system, it was called FamilyNet, where we could guarantee that you own your data and you could still share it. So there are technical possibilities. Through encryption, you can share things with people who have access to it, but it also means that you have a way to turn it off if you decide that, you know, you don't want to share it anymore. And there are things that you're happy to share publicly, and people have websites and other ways to share things. But I think you should think of this notion of it's more than just privacy. It's just our relationship to our digital belongings. I discovered recently that Facebook is facing situations where people die and they refuse to shut down their pages. Is this good? Is it bad? When you can look at it both ways, well, it's good if it's going to be there maybe forever, and that's maybe how you will get to know about your great-grandparents or something. But the fact that they apparently it's very hard for even relatives to get access to this, and I think it is a problem. And the fact that this notion of property has not been addressed in the digital realm is a real problem.
I don't think it can be addressed by the technical
exactly.
system.
Yeah.
You can own data. If you share it once, if one person in the world can access it, you could as well copy it somewhere else. You can own the file. So there is no technical way to.
It is true there is no technical way, but you can make a combination of technical and legal solutions. I mean, we have things like copyright. I mean, I can take a book in a library, I can make physical copies on a photocopier, and I can go out and sell it and make money off it in the street. Well, except there's a law that says I can't. Now, I think when you're online, you need a little bit of technical... but for example, I think every piece of data, that there should be a standard way of describing what is the status of data that you put on the web, and sort of watermark the data itself with that, so it's harder to temper. And that wouldn't be that difficult to do. I mean, these solutions exist in the exchange of legal documents or sensitive documents. So the technological solutions are there. The problem is that around social networks in particular, and the digital economy in general, we have these business models that are completely warped, in my opinion, where people give a service for free, but then, and because they're not making money out of that, they have to make money out of something else, and that is by, you know the saying that on the net, if something is for free, you are the product being sold.
So I think that's really what the problem is. And the reason it works, and I think it's something very important to understand, and that is related to this course, is the things that work is every time you put people in touch. Because people crave for communication. And so they're willing to abandon their privacy, to abandon every right to stuff they put online, just, you know, to have the ability to get in touch with friends and people they know or they don't know. I have a neighbor told me that, you know, she told her sons, you know, or kids, you cannot be on Facebook. I don't want you to be on Facebook. And to make sure you're not on Facebook, I'm going to be on Facebook so I can check that you're not on there. And so she did that. And then by being on Facebook, she got in touch with people she hadn't, high school friends she hadn't met in 30 years. And then suddenly she realized, oh shit, that's kind of cool. So I think that's what's really powerful about this. And the sad part of it is that companies, Facebook and not only Facebook, take advantage of the fact that people crave for this and don't pay attention to the other side of things.
Yeah, there is the issue of critical mass. You need critical mass to attract people. And that's why the only social networks that are successful were owned by companies with large...
I think that's wrong. I think that's wrong. And in fact, if you look at the history, in the early-ish days of Facebook, or when it was starting to grow, Google actually and other companies tried to create a standard for social networking. So the equivalent of SMTP for email, for social networking, and they went to Facebook to try to have them follow that standard, which would open the market for, you know, other than Facebook to be able to be part of the social network. And, you know, what Google's intentions were, I don't want to presume, they maybe not as pure as they were saying, but certainly Facebook refused. And I think that was, probably very smart on their side. But overall, I think it is hurting the consumer. Because I think there's a notion of public good. And, you know, what if the roads were privatized in a way that you have a car of a certain brand to ride a certain road? You know, that wouldn't work. And I think, you know, in the same way that the bandwidth for cell phones or for Wi-Fi are in fact auctioned by governments because they're seen as a public good and we make very strong rules for companies who want to use them, I think communication in the digital realm should be in the same sort of type of thing. Because I think it's insane to let companies have that much power for these kind of things.
Yeah, it might be insane, but they do have that problem.
I know, but you know,
it's too late to...
I know, I'm a researcher, so I can... idealistic views, and I know it's not going to happen. Although, you know, Facebook is not doing so well in because
I think Facebook, they were lucky at the beginning to reach that critical mass, and other ones.
But I have the same issue. I have the same issue with Google. I think having one. That's the problem, I think, with a lot of this notion of competition is good. Competition is good when it's real competition. But competition is not good when it ends up with one or sometimes two companies, you know, eating everything else. And that's what you have. And it's striking that you have this more in the digital realm than you have it in real when making physical products. I mean, you don't have a dominant car maker or dominant, I don't know, a fridge maker, or you have a real competition there. But, you know, if you think of productivity, it's Microsoft Office. If you think of search, it's Google, etc. If you think of music, it's iTunes. And I don't think it's, you know, healthy either. And I think what happened is that the old industry were created in an environment where there was a strong regulation put by the governments. And things like the telecom, I mean, you have to remember that in the early days and until quite recently, telecom companies were public companies, I mean, publicly owned. Des entreprises nationales, nationalized. They were owned by governments. I mean, the French telecom was owned by the government, same thing in Spain and all over Europe. They've been privatized only recently. And then what you have is a strong push, now that they're privatized, that the government shouldn't regulate and we should let the market forces do their thing. The problem is that if you do this, history shows that market forces are such that one will emerge and eat all the others. It's well known.
It's a big flaw in the system.
Yes. But then this is getting political, so I think we should have a break and then get back to less charged issues. Okay, so what time is it? Oh, it's late. Okay, let's take a 15-minute break.